It's the moon landings. It's when, I believe, in total 12 people have walked on the moon. And pretty soon it's going to be the 50th year anniversary of the first moon walk. First time anybody walked on the moon. So we're reminded of this because on PBS and quite a few other stations on Discovery Science and National Geographic, there are a lot of specials now about the moon. So right now I'm watching one, and as I said, it's my privilege to speak about it because it was an amazing thing that happened, and I'm going to talk about first how it was born. So, but if you think of this, it took quite a bit of technology, quite a bit of effort, took a purpose to get there, to even start the moon projects of Apollo, to send people to the moon, to walk on the moon. So I've said this before, that people like Einstein and other people that have made amazing discoveries, they don't have a book to go to and say, okay, I'll learn this. They actually invented it. It was difficult, but imagine if I'm asked now to go take a physics class, master's or PhD, how difficult it would be for any of us. And not just physics or math or a lot of things, but these people that did this, that invented these things, that discovered these things, and people that first went to the moon, nobody went before, nobody discovered this before. So they were doing this, just the first people to ever do this. So going to the moon, it was a big effort. So we're going to talk about, as I'm watching now, there's people shaking hands. There's Khrushchev and Kennedy shaking hands. So maybe that's a good place to start. Khrushchev and Kennedy, the Soviet Union and America. After World War II, there was the world was divided into the communist camp and I guess democratic camp led by the leaders of the free world, America, and there was a competition between these two worlds, and guess what? The Soviets were winning. They were sending people into space, or animals into space, before America did. They were doing it a lot more than America did. So how was this big effort of Apollo, which is going to, the anniversary is going to come up in about a week, and we are reminded of this now as we watch PBS or National Geographic. There's lots of shows now about this big effort of going to the moon. So, what happened? Why did Kennedy decide to do it? And why was it successful? And the reason I said why was it successful is it was things that politicians talked about, going to the moon. People were polled in America, and I think 60% said, we don't care about that. Maybe some of them said, okay, sure, let's do it. And another percentage said, we're indifferent. If you do it, fine. If you don't do it, we're not thinking about it. So 60% of the people were against it. But here comes Kennedy. And there's the political rivals talking about, we can't let the Soviet Union beat us. We can't let them have this technological edge. We can't let other countries think the Soviet Union is more technologically advanced. Our prestige is at stake. And I guess when we think about the Vietnam War, America didn't want to leave because even though they knew they couldn't win, their credibility, their prestige was at stake. So they kept going. So here were politicians talking about going to the moon. And Kennedy made speeches about it. And then I think after his first speech, he met with his advisors and he said, what have I done? We don't have the money to do this. They knew it was going to take a gargantuan leap, not just a leap of faith, a lot of money, a lot of effort. But the Soviet Union was winning the battle. They were beating America. And Kennedy said, we're going to go to the moon. So, how did they get from saying Kennedy says we're going to go to the moon to actually going to the moon? So, as I said, now I'm watching this PBS show while I'm speaking to you, and there's Kennedy, and he met with his advisors, and they said to him, we don't have the money to do this. And Kennedy agreed, we don't. But here he was saying, we're going to do this, and the next day he's having doubts about it. But anyway, here we have this rock in the sky, this big rock. It's called the moon. There's theories on the formation of the moon. And I guess the leading theory is some kind of planetoid struck our Earth, blew dust into the sky, into outer space, actually. Made a ring, the ring coalesced. And there we had the moon formed out of this. So I hope I'm saying the right thing, because coalesced or coalesced. Because I was watching a show about black holes the other day, and I thought it was called the Schwarzschild radius, but apparently how to pronounce it is Schwarzschild, something like that. So excuse my pronunciation if it's not correct. But anyway, this week we're going to have a big anniversary, and I don't know if many people care about this much. I sure do. But 50 years going to the moon. And not just that, if we look at the difference between 50 years ago and now, there were not, the Hubble Space Telescope didn't exist. The Fermi Space Telescope didn't exist. The Chandra X-ray Telescope didn't exist. They weren't building the James Webb Telescope. How many satellites and observatories are out there now? Many are circling Mars. There's two spacecraft that have left our solar system, Voyager 1 and Voyager 2. So this is a golden age of space. And what this show was saying 50 years ago, these astronauts, for example, John Glenn, first person American into space, he was like Christopher Columbus. So, Christopher Columbus came to the New World. And, of course, our First Nations people wish he hadn't. But here we go. John Glenn was our Christopher Columbus. So, what do we talk about next? What struck me about this show that I'm watching now is there was a town called Cocoa Beach. And I've been there. That's where the Cape Canaveral space launch, so I saw the space launch, the iconic tower. If I would have been not as cheap as I was that day, I would have paid my $80 to go inside the museum, and apparently included in it was a ride out to Cape Canaveral. But I saw it from afar, and the transformation of America from saying we're going to go to the moon to actually doing it was quite remarkable in a town like Cocoa Beach. Cocoa Beach is still a sleepy little town. It's above Daytona Beach a little bit, a couple hours drive, maybe an hour drive. And if I went there now, I'd say it's a sleepy town because I was there. But apparently it was sleepier, if that's a good way to put it, before Kennedy announced his ambitious program. There was Cocoa Beach was not even on the map. Nobody knew about Cocoa Beach or anything. If you ever watched the show I Dream a Genie, that's where the astronauts were stationed, in Cocoa Beach. So that's where NASA decided to put its launch vehicles, and overnight the town was transformed. It blew up into a famous town. And this was all because of the Apollo lunar program. So one of the things that caught me about the show tonight, that caught my attention, was something I've talked about before. The amazing technology that goes into all parts of, let's say, a space vehicle. So the launch pad, the tower that holds the rockets themselves. And it reminded me, just about an hour ago, I was watching where in their first test there were rockets launched that blew up right on the launch pad. Rockets that raised, or that raised off the ground about 10, 20 meters, and then they started to self-destruct. So it was a long way to go. And what I was reading about rockets, the amazing technology that went into things like nozzles in the rocket, the walls, the gas mixture inside that could have easily exploded, but they had to solve that technological riddle. So the space program started in America. And another thing that was interesting was a bunch of smiling faces. I believe it's 30, 40 men, because at that time there were no women astronauts. And there was all smiles. These men had their buzz cuts, and they went through the Air Force program, and that weeded out the people that could not be astronauts, because if you could fly a supersonic jet and handle that, then you're on your way to being an astronaut. But here's this group of 30 to 40 astronauts, young men in their 30s, I guess, a lot of them, with their beautiful suits. This was the 1960s, remember, so the fashions were definitely different. But here's these men with their buzz cuts, and they're all smiling. And they were very affable and very low-key. They were asked questions, and the commentator says a lot of them died, and died on their missions. So rockets blew up, re-entry, things like that. So a lot of men in the first group of astronauts, they perished. I don't have a list with me right now, but there was a lot of them. And we all remember Christy McAuliffe, where she was on one of the space shuttles, and she became a hero of not just young girls, but young boys, of everybody. So her craft blew up in the air. This happened a lot before. And a lot of astronauts died. So the young astronauts that were on that mission, they were unaware that, I guess they knew some of the risks were there. Like when you join the Air Force and you go into battle, you know you could die. But here's the astronauts, a lot of them died. And it reminds me of, believe the first, it wasn't really a spacewalk. And I'll try to get the name to you next time. I think about this quite often. There was an astronaut that was in a spacesuit. So of course the spacesuit was checked, pressurized, everything. And this person was going to go in a jet airplane and jump out of the airplane in, I guess, in our air. I don't know if it's which layer of the atmosphere it is. But he jumped, and there was a minuscule hole in his hand. Sorry, in the spacesuit where his hand was. So what happened was, because of the hole, his hand expanded to a gargantuan size. It could have exploded. And lucky for him, it didn't. So I don't know what spared him, but I can imagine that jumping out of a plane, and you know there's a risk. You know you're jumping way high, and his hand nearly blew up in his spacesuit because, I guess, the pressure difference, his hand totally expanded. The pressure difference inside the spacesuit was so different than the pressure outside, so he almost lost his hand, and I believe it was damaged. And I can imagine what it felt like, hoping to sink faster because your hand's going to explode. So I don't have something in front of me now, but you really have to search out PBS. There's a lot on the Apollo mission now. And as I said, there's something in Seattle about the moon landing. I believe they have one of the original moon crafts that went to the moon. They have it there in the Museum of Flight. So they might have renamed the road Martin Luther King Way. But if you go to nasa.gov, they'll talk about all the things that are happening in America in terms of the space program and the celebration of the Apollo 50 mission. Or sorry, the Apollo 11 mission that happened about 50 years ago. So now, you know what? I'm going to talk a little bit about the moon, because here it is, this barren, dusty, dry world. It's very dry. I believe the driest place on the Earth is in Chile, or one of the driest, in the Atacama Desert. It's probably a bit of rain every decade or two. So it's very dry, and I believe the Atacama Desert is nowhere near as dry as the moon. So let's talk about the moon. As I've said before, it's our buddy, it's our friend. It's a dead world, but it's very important for Earth. It stabilizes our tilt, and we have, what else? We have tides because of the moon. So let's talk about the moon. So here's the moon. I'm reading out of my big astronomy Bible from the Smithsonian Institute. It's called, just wait, I'll tell you now, Universe, the Definitive Visual Guide by the Smithsonian. So it's a beautiful book. And I could have paid it something like $100, but it was well worth it. So here we have the moon. I'm going to read something about the moon. And every time I read something, even though we know quite a bit about the moon, every time I read about it, there's something interesting that I find. So this is something I believe I read about in like 2003 or 2002 about the Barry Center. So let's talk about the Barry Center. The Barry Center is the center of mass between the Earth and the Moon. So it's located inside the Earth. So that's the center of the mass between the Earth-Moon system. So what actually happens is the Earth and the Moon both rotate around the Barry Center, which is located inside the Earth. And so in a way, yeah, we can say the Moon rotates around us, but actually it rotates around the Barry Center. And I believe the Sun has a barycenter, and the Sun has like 99.5% or higher of the mass of the solar system is all in the Sun. So the barycenter is located inside the Sun. So this is the barycenter of the whole solar system. So that includes all the moons, all the planets, all the asteroids, everything else. The barycenter is located inside the moon, or inside the Sun. So the Sun rotates around that barycenter, and everything else rotates around the barycenter. So the Moon and the Earth have a barycenter. So that's B-A-R-Y center, however you want to spell that. We're Canadians, so we say C-E-N-T-R-E. So here we have the Moon. And why is the barycenter located so deep inside the Earth and not somewhere in between the Moon and the Earth? Well, here's the reason. Even though it only has 1.2% of the mass of Earth, the Moon is still the fifth largest planetary satellite in the solar system. When full, it is the brightest object in our sky after the Sun, and its gravity exerts a strong influence over our planet. However, the Moon is too small to retain a substantial atmosphere, and geological activity has long since ceased, so it is a lifeless, dusty, and dead world. 12 men have walked on its surface, and over 838 pounds, or that's 380 kilograms, of lunar rock have been collected, but scientists are still not exactly sure how the moon formed. So here in this Smithsonian book, it shows, I guess, the leading theory is that some object crashed into our Earth, so in a glancing collision between a Mars-sized asteroid and Earth, a huge amount of silicate material was jetted away from Earth, from Earth's mantle. The ejected material formed a massive cloud of gas, dust, and rock. Heat was radiated away, and the cloud quickly began to cool. The majority of the ejected material went into a circular orbit around Earth, forming a clumpy, dense, donut-shaped ring. Rocks grew by mutual collisions until a single body dominated the ring. Sweeping up the remaining material, the moon was born. So that is the theory that discusses how the moon was formed. And I believe they think this is the theory because the composition of the moon, what it tells us was the only way this could have happened was if something glanced. The Earth hit it and all this material went up in the air. So it doesn't say if this Mars-sized object formed part of the material that went up in the air. It just basically says the Earth's mantle flew up in the air, was ejected or jetted up, and then eventually coalesced. So no one knows how exactly the moon was formed. So there's craters all over the moon. During the first 750 years of its life, the moon went through a period of heavy meteorite bombardment, which cracked the crust and created craters all over the surface. About 3.5 billion years ago, the rate of bombardment slowed, and there followed a period of considerable volcanic activity. So I guess it's, what's it called, the early to late heavy bombardment. At that time, there was apparently a lot of asteroids and whatever it was, meteors that struck the Earth and the Moon. And we're so lucky we weren't alive then. And there was lava. The rate of bombardment slowed, and there followed a period of considerable volcanic activity. Lava from 60 miles below the surface oozed up through cracks in the crust and filled large low-lying craters. The lava solidified, producing the dark, flat basaltic areas called maria. I guess maria is oceans, Latin. This volcanic activity stopped about 3.2 billion years ago, and since then the moon has been relatively dead. Many of the features formed in the early days of the moon's history have been destroyed by subsequent impacts. One of the most recent large craters is Copernicus, which was produced about 900 million years ago. So if you read that, the moon is a dead body. There's nothing really there. I keep promoting this. There's apparently a lot of helium-3 on the surface of the moon. And helium-3, if you collide two of them together, you get helium-4 and a lot of energy. So it's the final stage in the proton-proton cycle. So if you think about this, why did we want to go to the moon? All of a sudden now, why does Donald Trump say, let's go to the moon again? Within a few years, we're going to have people on the moon. So why do we go to the moon? Why do we have this expense where we're going to send a space station close to the moon? I believe it's called the Gateway Project. There's going to be a back and forth from the space station, back and forth landings on the moon. So why is America going to do this? Why are they going to spend all that money to do this? Well, my answer is, this is my answer, we are a spacefaring race. We've sent people into space. We have the International Space Station, which houses men and women doing experiments. And I guess NASA does a lot of experience on how long-term space flight will affect people, because when we're going to go to Mars, and we will go to Mars, probably within a decade, the moon is going to give us a lot of knowledge about the effects. And being on the International Space Station, there's a lot of things learned about how living in space affects the human body. So when America first went into space, we can imagine the amount of knowledge then and the amount of knowledge now, what we know about our universe or our solar system or the both. It is radically it's exponential in terms of how much knowledge that we've learned. So probably one of the first things that we learned that surprised us then, and a lot of things don't seem to surprise us now. When a rocket blasts off and goes to the International Space Station, it's not even news anymore. Maybe it's told on the news, but nobody pays attention to it. Don't really care, do we? It's just an everyday thing now. But back then, when America and the Soviets were vying for, they were contesting the space, so I guess it was called the space race, and this probably drove Kennedy to, that's probably what drove Kennedy to go to the moon, is they didn't know space was magnetized. There was radiation, there was the Van Allen belts, and this is key in terms of living on Mars or going to Mars. How's this radiation going to affect an astronaut on possibly what could be a three-year voyage? So there's a certain window, launch window, when it's ideal for, it's the shortest distance, the shortest amount of time to go to the Mars. But after that, Mars moves and Earth moves, so the distance between the two bodies, Earth and Mars, will vary. And at one point, the Earth could be at one side of the of its orbit, and Mars is on the totally other side of its orbit. So we're not going to try to come back then, have to wait until Mars is close enough for the spaceship to do the shortest amount of travel. And this will mean that someone will be in the moon, or sorry, Mars, for probably a long time. So even if they land on the Mars and come back later, it's going to be a long voyage. So what we're going to learn from the moon will certainly help us on our voyage eventually to Mars. And if anybody, let's say I call myself an amateur astronomer, and I love astronomy. I think about it all day, every day. I read things, watch TV shows. It's part of me. It's part of my, I guess, my blood. Now, if I were to have a serious discussion with somebody who's not really interested in astronomy or doesn't follow it, or someone that might be interested, but say, they might say, yeah, astronomy is cool, but they really don't follow it. Now, we're going to speculate now. We're going to get a few people together, and we're going to talk about how life is going to change in 10, 20, 30 years from now when we go to this lifeless world, which is called Mars, because we've been to another lifeless world called the moon. So what we learn from the moon is going to help on our way to Mars. And I don't know if I'll be around, but there could be eventual colonies on Mars where they, I keep saying they, where the human race goes and lives on Mars. And there's talk about going to another star because, as we know, Stephen Hawking says we have maybe 100 years left on Earth. Who knows? It's a prophecy. It's his prediction. We don't know if it's going to be true or not. But if we send someone to the nearest star system to visit it, it's going to be a one-way trip because it's going to take it's 4.3 light years away. And to get there, if we ever travel fast enough, it could take 20, 30, 40, 50 years, a whole lifetime. So we're going to be sending people to go, like Christopher Columbus. We're going to go conquest a planet over there. Okay, so let's talk about the moon's orbit, because orbit is very important. And in terms of going to the moon or going to Mars, the orbit is an important thing because, especially Mars, there's a window where it's the shortest trip. If people do take that trip, probably it's going to take 6 months. By the time they get to Mars, if they turn around and come right back, it's another 6 months, so it's a year. By that time, Mars and Earth will be quite far apart, so I believe they have to stay up there for quite a few months in terms of waiting for Mars and Earth to kind of line up again. So it's the shortest distance back. So let's talk about orbit, because that's going to be a very important thing. The orbit of the Moon and the orbit of Mars when people go to Mars. Okay, the Moon has an elliptical orbit around the Earth as the distance between the two bodies varies. So there was probably speculation, and a lot of scientific theories start out as speculation, don't they? They'll say, this is my theory, now I'm going to test it. So there was thinking that the seasons were caused because, for example, we're warm here now, it's summer. And it's because the tilt is tilted towards the sun. It has nothing to do with the distance between the sun and the earth. So I believe in the winter, that's when the earth, our winter, the earth is at its closest point to the sun. I hope I'm saying this correct. And it has nothing to do with the seasons because we're close, but we used to have winter. So it's the tilt. So the Moon moves on an elliptical orbit around Earth. At its closest to Earth, it's called perigee. So that's P-E-R-I-G-E-E. The Moon is 10% closer than when it is at farthest point, which is called apogee. The Moon takes 27.32 Earth days to spin on its axis, which is the same time it takes to orbit the Earth. This is known as synchronous rotation and keeps one side of the Moon permanently facing Earth. Although eccentricities in the Moon's orbit, called librations, allow a few regions of the far side to come into view. So there is other bodies in the solar system that have this, I guess it's called locked or geosynchronous orbit. So if we have a satellite above us in Vancouver or above Canada, its speed is going to be such that as it orbits the Earth, and a lot of satellites do this, it will move at the same speed of the Earth, so it will stay in the same spot of the sky. So the Moon is in geosynchronous orbit with the Earth. So one side of the Moon permanently faces the Earth. And as it says, eccentricity. So I looked at a table the other day about planetary data, and it talked about eccentricities, and I still don't know what that means. I think I've read it somewhere, but you read it and you don't remember it. So there's a lot of things about astronomy, and I gotta promise myself next show I'll come on and I'll explain what I think an eccentricity is. And I know all you expert astronomers are giggling at me now, because that's probably one of the easiest concepts to remember. And if you were on here right now, you could tell me what an eccentricity is. So something to do with the orbit or whatever. Is it anomaly? I love using that word, anomaly. Because the Earth is moving around the Sun, the Moon takes 29.53 Earth days to return to the same position relative to the Sun on Earth's sky, completing its cycle of phases. There is also the length of a lunar day, the time between successive sunrises on the Moon. Okay, so here's a beautiful, beautiful picture. Like, this book is all beautiful. And it shows apogee and perigee. And when I see in the middle of this page, there's a giant Moon. And recall when I used to take out my telescope, it was as exciting as possible to view the Moon. And you view the Moon when it's in one of its phases. You don't view it when it's bright in the sky, when there's a full Moon. So the Terminator, the line between day and night on the Moon, that's where you look, and that's where you see the most beautiful, awe-inspiring craters. And I know I've said this once or twice in the show. Someone I talked to once said, as much as he could, weather affects this. But for 1 year, he studied the Moon, and every day that he studied it was so exciting, so inspiring. And being an astronomer, looking up in the sky, using your telescope, it's one of the biggest thrills that I've ever gotten. So let's talk about the moon's spin and orbit. The moon's orbital path is tilted at an angle to Earth's equator, causing its path across the sky to vary in an 18-year cycle. Okay, so I didn't know that. So its path across the sky varies in an 18-year cycle. One thing I have noticed about the moon is when you look up at the moon, it doesn't move right along the ecliptic. The ecliptic, the parent path of the sun, is quite high in the sky, and if you look at the moon, it's lower. It moves in a similar path, but not right on the ecliptic. So that's one of the things I noticed. Tidal forces. You know what? I'm sorry about this. I'm pausing because I have to. It's quite dark in this room. So tidal forces mean that the moon is slowing down Earth's rotation while the moon moves away from the Earth at a rate of 1 inch or 2.5 centimeters each year. So I thought it was due to some kind of the Earth is stealing some of our gravitational energy. So as it moves away, it slows the Earth down. So the Earth every year gets a little slower in its spin. So what is the structure of the moon? The lunar crust is made of calcium-rich, granite-like rock. It is about 30 miles thick on the near side and 46 miles thick on the far side. Because of the moon's history of meteorite bombardment, the crust is severely cracked. So I want to somehow visualize this. One side of the moon always faces us. The other side is always facing away from us. But that side, although we call it the dark side of the moon, does receive light. So I guess when there's a half moon, half of the dark side receives light. And when there's a full moon, or when there's a new moon, and the moon is there's no light in the sky, I suppose the face of the dark side is completely lit 100% by the sun. And when there's a full moon, it's possible that the dark side receives no light. So that's just my theorizing. Tell me if I'm wrong or if I'm right. Because of the moon's history of meteor... Oh, I read that. I'm sorry. So I'm going to keep going on. The lower mantle lies about 600 miles below the surface. So I don't know how scientists know this. Below the crust. And here the rock gradually becomes partially molten. So if it's molten, how come it doesn't have a magnetic field? The average density of the moon indicates that it might have a small iron core. The Apollo missions measured the velocities of shock waves traveling through the moon, but the results proved... Now here's a nice word. I thought it said moonclusive, but inconclusive, so I thought they were playing on words. Further seismic evidence is needed to confirm the existence of a metal core. So this is my own... of course, we dream big sometimes and we think, okay, well, I'm going to be in charge of one of these great missions. I'm going to be in charge of a telescope or some kind of spacecraft that's going somewhere. So what I think is, why not put something on the moon, for example, a rocket launch system? Because if a meteor, if we see it coming to Earth, we can shoot it down from the moon. Why not? So that's my purpose for the moon. So now I'm just going to read a couple of lines of data about the moon. So the average distance from the Earth is about 384,000 kilometers or 238,900 miles. So I believe the Earth is, let me get this right, the moon is 40 times farther from, oh, The sun is 40 times farther from the earth, or 400 times, yes, that's right, 400 times farther from the earth than the moon is. So the sun is very far, 400 times. And I believe the sun is about 400 times bigger than the moon. So this situation is not going to last. We're the only body on the in the solar system where we can have a total eclipse in about, I guess, pretty soon, maybe 60 million years. As the moon moves farther and farther out from the Earth, it inches away, like 3 inches every year, or no, 2.54 inches. It will eventually be the end of total solar eclipses. So there will be no more eclipses. So right now the moon and the Earth is the only system. The surface temperature of the moon is minus 240 degrees Celsius to 240 degrees. Oh, sorry, minus 240 degrees Fahrenheit to 240 degrees Fahrenheit. So it goes from minus 240 to plus 240. And I believe the lips of some of the craters, which never receive sunlight, could be amongst the coldest places in our solar system. So it's very cold there because no sun gets there. Okay, so the diameter of the moon is 2,160 miles. Volume of the Earth, 0.002. So how many moons does the moon have? Nothing. So the moon has a 1.2% mass of the Earth. Observation, the amount of the sunlit moon visible from Earth varies throughout the month, starting with a thin crescent in the western sky just after sunset. The month ends with a thin crescent moon visible in the east just before dawn. Rotation period, 27.32 Earth days. Length of a day on the moon, 29.53 Earth days. Mass of the Earth, 0.012. Gravity at the equator, 0.165. So it's 1/6 the gravity. So if we were to be on the moon, we'd weigh less. So let's all go to the moon, and then we don't have to go on a diet. So there's some interesting things about the moon, and probably the ancients, we can study what they believed in terms of the lunar influences. And not just that, there's a lot of interesting things when the Egyptians, the ancient Egyptians, they knew it was going to be the first day of summer because I believe one of the stars, I don't want to say the wrong star, it could be Sirius, S-I-R-I-U-S. It could be Rigel or it could be Betelgeuse. I don't remember. Like I promise, I'm going to get that to you by the next show. So when the first day of summer comes, that's when this star rises, is on the horizon just when the sun is rising. So it varies throughout the year, and they knew that's when to plant the crops because they looked at the sky and certain stars, certain heavenly bodies signaled certain things were going to happen. So there was lots of lunar influences and stellar influences. So let's look at the lunar influence. What things do we believe about the moon? Well, let's talk about, here's one, werewolves. Many myths and old folk tales attribute strange powers to the moon. Some say that a full moon can turn people, and the origin of the word lunacy, and many cultures from Eurasia to the Americas share a belief that when the moon is full, some humans can be transformed into vicious werewolves. Werewolves. The superstition is widespread and ancient. Even the Babylonian king Nebuchadnezzar, 630 before Christ to 562 before Christ, imagined that he had become a werewolf. So let's look about some other lunar influences. Although the moon is much smaller than Earth, its gravity still exerts an influence. I thought it was going to talk about myths, but no. It's going to talk about actual physical influences. The moon's gravitational attraction is felt most strongly on the side of Earth facing the moon. And this pulls water in the oceans toward it. inertia, the tendency of objects with mass to resist forces acting upon them, attempts to keep the water in place, but because the gravitational force is greater, a bulge of water is pulled towards the moon. On the opposite side of Earth, the water's inertia is stronger than the moon's gravity, so a second bulge of water is created. As Earth rotates, the bulges sweep over the planet's surface, creating daily changes in sea level called tides. The time of the high tide changes according to the moon's position in the sky. The height of the tides changes during the lunar cycle, but the actual height also depends on local geography. In shallow coastal bays, the tidal range can be huge. So again, I'm reading this from a book. I'm not a genius. Imagine somebody had to invent this stuff or discover this stuff. Not invent, they had to discover this stuff. So from what we're talking about, the moon and the Apollo, we're going to celebrate the Apollo moon landing quite soon, within a week, I think. At that time, 50 years ago, anyone can imagine how much our human species knew about outer space compared to what they know today, and the amount of spacecraft and rockets and whatever you have, observatories out in outer space. So here it shows the tidal bulges. Gravitational interaction between Earth and the Moon creates two bulges in Earth oceans, exaggerated here. So it shows an exaggerated bulge. As Earth spins on its axis, the bulges of water sweep over the surface, creating tides. So there's another thing about the tidal range. The magneta in the satellite image of Morecambe Bay on the northwest coast of England reveals the inlets and mud flats that are left exposed at low tide. So here's a photo that's proving the tide. So let's talk about the surface of the moon. The surface of the moon has been pulverized by meteorites and is covered by a rough, porous blanket of rubble several yards thick. So on the Bennu mission, it's on an asteroid now. It's called regolith on the surface. So it's not called regolith on the moon surface. And by the way, I'm getting a lot of emails from the people at the Bennu because I'm a NASA ambassador, so I got to get my, you know what, into gear and learn about this so I can start giving speeches about the Bennu mission. But I'm getting a lot of emails where they need volunteers to staff these displays for the Apollo 15 celebrations. Apollo 50 celebrations. Okay, back to the article. Actually, it's called regolith. It is. The soil, or regolith, consists of fine-grained fragmented bedrock that Fred Flintstone crushed. The size of the grains getting progressively larger with depth. Since there is no wind or rain, the surface material does not move far, and its composition can change considerably from place to place. So there's no wind or rain on the moon. Isn't that something? We might like that. The thickness also, we in Vancouver, the thickness also varies. In Young Mare regions, it is about 16 feet or 5 meters thick, but this increases to 32 feet or 10 meters in the old highlands. Micrometeorite impacts continuously erode exposed rocks, and they are also damaged by cosmic rays and solar flare particles. The topmost layer of soil is saturated with hydrogen ions absorbed from the solar wind. So, of the billions and trillions of things that could have gone right, that did go right to let us have, we are living on Earth, there's life here. Imagine the billion things, or one or two of things that could have gone wrong to make life impossible. So that's what happened on the moon. It's a very dry, lifeless world. And here they have a nice moon rock. So it says, this 6-inch, 15-centimeter wide rock formed as lava from the interior rose to the moon's surface and solidified. The small holes were formed as gas bubbles escaped. Okay, so now they're talking about here craters on the moon. And I'm sure there's this famous crater. What's it called? It's called material ejected from a crater during an impact is also confined to normal to narrow jets. Where this material hits the surface, it plows up the lunar soil, and this disturbed region then reflects more moonlight than its surroundings from Earth. From Earth, these appear as rays. The rays around Tycho Crater, so that's the one I was looking at, Tycho Crater, far right, extend for thousands of miles. Okay, so I'm going to wrap up my show now about our friend the moon. And the last week I talked about two of the gas giants, or I guess the ice giants. And there's more to talk about the moon. And there's beautiful pictures of the moon, the near side and the far side. And there's more things about different craters and different features. But this year we're going to celebrate something. We're going to celebrate 50 years since humans walked on the moon. So I think it'll be exciting when a woman eventually, within a few years, is going to walk on the moon. That will be a great triumph and will inspire a lot of young girls, teenage girls and school-age girls to become astronauts. So to wrap up this show, we're talking about one of the greatest scientific feats of all was landing people on the moon safely and returning them. And we've watched Tom Hanks in Apollo 13. Houston, we have a problem where something went wrong, but they still returned safely. So this celebration of the moon is actually, you can say it's a celebration of us as a species to never stop asking questions, never stop digging, never stop discovering. And when I went to see Dr. Krukin give a beautiful speech at Science Center, somebody stood up at the end, put up their hands. One of the first questions was, why do we waste our money on this nonsense of going into outer space? Well, I'm going to answer that. A couple of shows ago, talked about going to the moon was all the spin-off of the technology to miniaturize things, to make computers that launched the computer revolution. So that's probably the biggest spin-off from going to the moon and from being in space. But there's no denying it. We are a spacefaring race. We're the only proven form of life in our universe. So that's things we're going to celebrate. And it's kind of wonderful that our quest, our thirst for knowledge has never stopped, because we're going to go to the moon again and then Mars and maybe colonize the solar system. So imagine 50 years from now, or 100 years from now, your grandchild's going to be eating KFC on Titan, the moon from the largest moon of Saturn. So it's exciting, our future. If we compare 50 years ago to now, imagine all the wonderful, like Hubble's one of them. Hubble's been up there for 25 years. It's our Hubble Space Telescope. That, I think, is from my opinion, that is the greatest scientific achievement of our race ever, was the Hubble Space Telescope. And from space, we can say we're down here on Earth. We go, well, there's a lot of scientists that have discovered how to cure heart disease or make new valves or do certain things for heart surgery. And you know what? A lot of those were perfected in outer space, or the spin-off technologies to get plasma, or let's say organs. So in organ transplants, how to cool the organs so they are able to take the organ out of somebody. And it's a sad story. Yes, you're taking an organ out of a person that has just expired, but you're keeping it alive enough so it could be transported to the next place to be inserted or transplanted into somebody else. And Triumph has to, our Triumph nuclear device, or that nuclear what's it called? I'm not going to say a monster, that place where nuclear research takes place. Let's call it nuclear heaven. To me, that's nuclear heaven. Isotopes that have to be transported, that are made at Triumph, are transported to Australia and New Zealand. Some of the technologies that keep these things are made in outer space. So Teflon, that's one.